Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So in today's episode, I wanted to talk more about stress and its impact specifically on progesterone levels. Now, progesterone levels are indeed declining in perimenopause. It's the first of the two hormones to start to change as we move into perimenopause from our regular cycling years in our 30s. As we start to move physiologically into perimenopause, that's the first thing. We start seeing declining levels of progesterone. Later on, we then start to see a change in how estrogen is fluctuating. So instead of a gentle ebb and flow, it becomes more erratic. And that in itself brings about the various symptoms that are associated with those high spikes and sharp drops of estrogen that we all know about. If you've listened to previous episodes where I've really gone into more detail about that. Even though it is natural that progesterone levels are declining as we move into perimenopause, it's also possible to minimize that decline or say delay its decline. At least in the early stages of perimenopause anyway. And I've been personally doing that myself for the last 5 years. So since turning 40, I then started to notice a shortening of my menstrual cycles just by a couple of days, which would mean because we make progesterone around midway through our cycle and then we enjoy its benefits for the last half of our cycle until we come on our period again, where my cycles were shortening, which is very, very characteristic of those early stages of perimenopause, I was then obviously I'm having less time with progesterone because I'm coming on my periods earlier now and I'm probably still ovulating around the same time in that cycle, but the last half is shorter than it was when I was, say, 39, 38. So I knew then that I'd be having less time with progesterone, which is one of the reasons that progesterone declines. And also I started to notice as I turned, say, 42, 43, that I was ovulating later in the cycle. So not only was I ovulating a bit later and I was coming on a bit earlier, so now I was having even less time with progesterone. And then I started to pick up on the fact that some months there was no ovulation occurring at all. And the way that I track my ovulation personally is by taking my body temperature every morning as soon as I wake up. It's called basal body temperature tracking. And tracking that throughout the month in my cycles tracking app. And from there, I know when I've had this slight spike in my temperature about midway through my cycle, which lasts, that spike in temperature level lasts all the way until I come on again. And I know that that is a signal that I did manage to ovulate, because when we make progesterone, our temperature, body temperature in the morning gradually goes up by a little bit. So I can do another episode talking about that specifically. And I have talked about that actually in previous episodes. I think it'd be episode 9 where I talked about the importance of progesterone and how we can support our bodies to ovulate as much as possible so that we make progesterone. But really what I'm doing here is just a little bit of a recap before I get into what I actually wanted to talk about today. but what I'm trying to say is, in a nutshell, we have the ability to minimize the decline of progesterone that is a natural part of perimenopause starting in the early stages, but we can do things to support our body to, number one, to keep ovulating as many months as possible, and support how well that ovulation occurs, because how well that ovulation occurs supports how much progesterone we actually make. And just generally supporting our bodies as best we can in terms of ovulation and healthy cycle lengths, we can really just support and sort of minimize that reduction in progesterone. Because, as I said again, go back and listen to episode 9, which where I really go into more detail about progesterone. But as a reminder, some of progesterone's wonderful benefits are that it prevents this sort of situation of estrogen dominance, which is where if we don't make progesterone in that that particular cycle, we have a cycle that is essentially dominated by estrogen, because estrogen is just left alone without its partner hormone coming to join it halfway through. And that can lead to the typical sort of symptoms of this situation of estrogen not being balanced out by its partner, which is heavy periods, clotting, painful periods, breast pain in the last couple of weeks before we come on, mood swings, even like rage and headaches for some women as well. So it prevents that estrogen dominant situation from occurring. And it's also really important for our kind of overall sense of equilibrium and contentment with life, and our just overall sense of joy and contentment with our days, with our world around us. It's really important for good sleep, really important for mood. It increases a brain chemical called GABA, which promotes calm, relaxation. It's anti-anxiety. It helps our thyroid glands to make enough thyroid hormone. It boosts our metabolism through what's known as its thermogenic actions, which means it raises body temperature and therefore boosts our metabolism. It protects our nerve cells, supports healthy blood flow to the brain. It even supports new bone formation. We tend to talk about estrogen a lot in terms of bone health, but new research supports progesterone for new bone formation. So that's obviously going to be really important for the strength and density of our bones, both now and later. A study on progesterone and bone health found that women were losing 1% of bone each year in perimenopause with what we call anovulatory cycles. So cycles where there has been no ovulation. So a healthy cycle is called an ovulatory cycle, meaning you ovulate around halfway through and you make progesterone. A non-ovulatory or anovulatory cycle means cycles are still regular. They can still look and feel completely normal, but there wasn't ovulation halfway through. So those non or anovulatory cycles were showing that women were losing 1% of bone each year due to having no progesterone in those months. Because that progesterone was found to be protective, particularly in spinal bone density. So really important to know these things. You would know from symptoms whether you ovulated that particular cycle, because what's happening in perimenopause is that we're just ovulating less and less. So it could mean that, for example, in what we would call in inverted commas regular menstrual cycling years, which would be 20s, 30s, up to sort of late 30s when we move into perimenopause, in those regular cycling years, ideally, in the typical situation for the typical person is that they're probably managing to ovulate every month quite easily. Once we're in perimenopause, that changes. And it might be that in the early stages of perimenopause, which was my story, sort of 40, 41, I was maybe ovulating most months, but then there'd be the odd one where I just didn't ovulate. And that was not happening in my 30s. And then for some women, it could be that they ovulate 2 months, then they don't ovulate for 2 or 3 months, then they ovulate once, then they don't ovulate again twice, or vice versa. But and the person who's ovulating less and less, so each month it's more the fact that they don't ovulate rather than they do, that their progesterone is declining much faster, much more so than the other person who's just still skipping some ovulation months, but not as many. So you would know from your symptoms in the second half of your cycle. For example, if you start to notice it in that second half of your cycle, in the week to two weeks before your period is due, increased anxiety beyond what you feel, has been there normally, increased stress, less resilience to stress, more sleep issues, really finding it hard to sleep in that last 10 to 14 days, let's say, the horrible breast pain, breast tenderness, mood swings, a really horrible period when it does come, then you could say that you probably didn't ovulate in that particular month. And it might be every month, it might be the odd month here or there. So regular, what this study was basically concluded was that regular but non-ovulatory cycles, we can still have very regular, like I said, normal feeling and looking cycles, but they may not be ovulatory. So these regular cycles but non-ovulatory cycles, or regular cycles with very much shorter luteal phases like I was having, and skipped cycles, so now they're getting longer, further and fewer between, have been shown to impact bone, because they just have this, because women who preserve their progesterone in perimenopause have less bone loss. So in a nutshell, what I'm saying is, We really do, as we move into perimenopause, want to be doing everything we can to support our bodies to ovulate as much as we can. And the purpose of the one thing I wanted to focus on in this particular episode is that most of the time, when a woman doesn't ovulate normally, it's because she's stressed by something. It could be physiological stressors like blood sugar swings, illness, infection, even undereating. But the most common stresses today, particularly for women of perimenopausal age, so sort of late 30s all the way through their 40s, the most common source of stress is what we would call social stress. So, for example, thinking of the fact that most women have essentially two jobs, in inverted commas. So, for example, they work in the home, they are in charge of their home, they're in charge of keeping their home, you know, in check in a certain way, organizing everything within the home. Just really getting all of that. That is a job in itself, running a household. But then they also have their job or their career outside of the home. Maybe not physically outside of the home, maybe they work from home, but you know, they have these two things that they, these two huge responsibilities, which are both essentially full-time. Any conflicts as well within important relationships within their life. So for example, conflicts with a partner, conflicts with a boss, a family member, the stresses that are caused by being overcommitted, having all these multiple different responsibilities each all week, work stress, you know, having to juggle it all. Maybe they are an emotional support for somebody or multiple people, whether that's children, other family members, even friends. And aging parents is a huge one, because obviously as we're in our 40s, our parents are getting older. And so that may come with health issues, health scares, dependence, reliance on you to support them physically or whatever it might be, mentally. It can be a lot to juggle. And this is most of the time when we don't ovulate, it's because of this kind of stress, as opposed to, you know, what we might be thinking like, oh, but my job isn't that busy, or, you know, I don't have loads of stress, whatever, I'm not grieving, or whatever else you might think is a stressor. Yes, those things are stressors, but a lot of us are overlooking the fact that just life in general for women of this age, are in this particular age bracket, can just be the stress. And that doesn't mean, oh, great, so there's nothing I can do. That's what this episode is about. I want to talk about the things that we can do. But just to highlight some stressors that you may not have thought were actually stressors in the first place. And then from there, we can know what to do. So the body can also, another source of stress, I'm going to label a few more as well and keep talking about the kind of social stress, but the body can become more stressed in perimenopause. It does become more stressed in perimenopause as the change in how estrogen is ebbing and flowing that I mentioned earlier, and that low progesterone really does cause the brain to freak out. The brain is used to a certain level of progesterone every month and a certain ebbing and flowing of estrogen and healthy levels of estrogen every month. So suddenly, as we physiologically move into this perimenopause phase of life and estrogen starts fluctuating more erratically and progesterone starts declining, now the brain is like stressed. It's like, what is going on? I don't understand. It's confused. Why are hormones not fluctuating like they used to anymore? Why is it all so erratic? Why is there not enough progesterone coming into my brain? Because progesterone crosses into the brain and increases the brain chemical GABA, for example, that's calming. So this extra stress, this physiological stress, is an extra stress on the body as we start, our hormones start to come out of rhythm. And estrogen itself, when it's in normal physiological levels, plays a protective positive role on what's known as the HPA axis. So HP stands for, the H is the hypothalamus in the brain. The P is for the pituitary, which is another gland in the brain below the hypothalamus. And the A stands for the adrenal glands. And axis means communication. So HP is the brain and the A is the adrenal. So it's the brain to adrenal connection, communication. The adrenal glands are the glands responsible for releasing our stress hormones when the brain signals to them to do so. So this change in these physiological levels of estrogen and progesterone disrupts that HPA axis, that brain to adrenal gland communication. So when estrogen, for example, is swinging too high and then dropping too low on its roller coaster, coupled with low progesterone, the brain stresses out, the body stresses out. So stress is a big thing to be looking at now. And we have to look at, you know, because I hear a lot of women say, for example, but my job isn't any more stressful now than it was in my 30s, or, you know, my life load isn't any more stressful now than it was in my 30s. In fact, I've probably got less stress now than I did then. But what we have to take into account is that there's this additional, this physiological stress now, where the brain and the body is stressing out because of the change in hormones, which leaves us more sensitive to stress. So even though it may be the case that stress hasn't changed, stress levels haven't changed, or I hear a lot as well, I used to exercise like this in my 30s, why can I not, you know, I used to do 5 spin classes a week in my 30s, why can I suddenly not cope with them anymore? It's because, again, we've become more sensitive to stress with this change, this physiological change in estrogen and progesterone and how they're behaving. That is another major source of stress for the brain. Also, diet stress, so undereating, usually by accident. So many women are undereating by accident, still not eating enough good fats in their day, still not packing enough protein into their meals, still not eating just enough food overall. They're still hungry in between all of their meals and wondering why, because their meal hasn't been big enough, or, you know, satiating enough and giving them enough of the right nutrition each meal. So undereating unknowingly is another stress. Eating low fat, eating low protein, these are all stresses, dietary stresses on the body, causing blood sugar swings. So blood sugar really high 1 minute, a blood sugar drop the next. This is a physiological stress where the signals to the brain are being sent that you're not doing okay. This is not a good time to ovulate. So even just dietary stress alone can be enough to tell your brain you're not okay. This is not a safe time. Let's not let ovulation occur. So the stuff as well that we need in order to make our hormones, like all the different good fats that we should be eating, all the different types of good fats we should be getting every day, lots of different colorful vegetables, all the different nutrients that we find in good quality, nutrient-rich animal proteins. If we're not getting enough of all these foods, then the body just isn't getting enough of what it needs to make our hormones. So even if we do manage to ovulate, for example, it might be difficult to ovulate so well that we make as much progesterone that we should, because we just don't have the right, what we call, cofactor nutrients there to support that production of progesterone. Even just being a tiny bit dehydrated as well is stressful for the body. So the brain is picking up on this dehydration. So if you're someone drinking a lot of caffeine and no water or very little water, or even if you don't drink any caffeine and it's just lack of water generally, you really, really do need to address this, because it could be the tiny little thing that's just standing in the way. You know, I speak to so many people as well that say, I have such a good diet, I just don't know, you know, what's the missing piece? What am I doing wrong? And usually hydration is the biggest thing that's being missed by a lot of people. So thinking about, you know, what you're drinking through the day, how much water are you taking in? If there is caffeine or a lot of caffeine, you need to be replacing, you know, more water. You need to be drinking more water than you would be without that caffeine being there, because it's so dehydrating. Over-exercising. So many women are doing like 4 or 5 HIIT classes a week. Now there's a, you know, as I said, spin classes or other really intense workout styles. Now HIIT has got kind of confused. That's the real meaning of HIIT, high intensity interval training, has been confused and I would say exploited as well over the years. And that the real meaning of high intensity interval training is that your intervals of work, say for example, a sprint, whether it's a sprint on a bike or a sprint on a treadmill or a sprint on a rowing machine or up a hill outside, that actual amount of time that you're spending doing that sprint, let's say it's 30 seconds or whatever it might be, for that to be, you know, really, really intense and then have a rest period in between and then to go again, the real meaning of high intensity interval training is that we can only actually do that for, let's say, no more than like 15, maximum 20 minutes, including all of the rest periods that you're having in between those intervals of work. But today's HIIT classes are like 45, 60 minutes. And they're essentially just weight circuits where you're doing little rounds of on and off for 45 to 60 minutes. It's not the genuine high intensity interval training that should only be done for, like I said, 15, 20 minutes at the most. So most people are really overdoing it by doing these these multiple HIIT classes per week. Like I said, spin as well. It's too long. These are just, these classes are sending signals to the brain for most women to say that they're not okay. This is not a good time to be ovulating, because they're constantly just running from something, essentially, if we tie this all back to how our stress response began hundreds and hundreds of years ago, was to save us from running from, when we're running from a tiger, to save our life. And some women are exercising too late into the evening because it's the only chance they get in their busy schedules. And I really do understand that. I'm lucky enough to work so flexibly that I can just put it into my, my morning or my lunch break or early afternoon at the latest. But so many women just only get a chance to get to the gym at like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, or whatever it is they might do class wise. And then, or they're waking up super early in the morning, depriving themselves of that extra hour of sleep to get their run in or their HIIT class or whatever it is. And again, this tells the brain things are not okay. Exercising intensely at 8 o'clock at night, getting up at 5 a.m. to exercise intensely after not having a very good night's sleep or having only been asleep for a few hours, you know, this is telling the brain things aren't okay. Let's not allow the body to ovulate. Something else that can leave your brain perceiving that things aren't okay is that you're not happy. You know, this, your brain knows this. Your brain knows when you're unhappy. It knows when you're not enjoying your life as much as we should. And it will say, now is not a good time to ovulate. Not being who you want to be or doing things that you want to be is another stress that I think a lot of us aren't actually realizing. Many of us don't even know that we're not living how we want to live, because, you know, so many of us are on autopilot at this stage of life. We're just sort of going through the motions and just assuming without even thinking that this is what we want to do, or this is just what we have to do. And we think, well, it's too late to change things. Oh, I wish I'd done that differently. But hey ho, here's where I am now. I have to live with it. That is a stressor if that's how we're feeling, if that's what's going on. And even down to saying yes to certain social engagements. If we wanted to say no, but we said yes, how many times do you, I'd probably count on a day, daily basis, how many times do you say yes when you actually wanted to say no? I hear this all the time, and I was 100% that person that just said yes all the time when I really just wanted to say no, but I thought I couldn't say no. I thought it was rude. I thought I just had to say yes. If that's what this person wants, then I will say yes. If I've been invited, I will say yes. And I hear it all the time, people saying, now I can't say no, it's rude, but that person wants me there, or whatever it might be, I'd better say yes. But we have to start now more than ever at this phase of life doing what we actually want to do, saying no to the things we don't want to do. And we don't have to think of excuses or give excuses or explain ourselves. A simple no, thank you. No, that doesn't suit me. No, I won't be joining. You know, just a simple no will actually probably be received far better than you thought. So thinking about what you actually want. If you don't know, now's the time to sit and be like, not sit, but, you know, just all the time at the back of your mind, think, I don't even know what I want. I am just going through the motions. I am living on autopilot. What do I want? Maybe I do love all of this and I just need to know that and figure that out, you know. And if you don't love anything about your life, how can you start, even in the most tiniest of ways, making it more in alignment with what you do want and who you actually want to be? Because we can do these things really subtly, very small, tiny little changes. It can go a long way to telling your brain that everything's fine, and we can ovulate. A lot of us are stuck in cycles of work and responsibilities within the home, as I said, for our kids, for family commitments, other people that might rely on us for support. And that relentless cycle just goes round and round, day after day, week after week, month after month. It doesn't really give us a chance to even consider these things. So now is really a time to think about these things. Nor does this relentless cycle, autopilot living, it doesn't give us any time to offer ourselves the care that we need. So I always ask, you know, how much are you giving to the outside world, but leaving yourself and your own like inner world completely depleted? And for most people, that will be, the answer will be a lot. I'm giving a lot to the outside world, saying all the yeses, never saying no, even when I want to. And I'm not leaving any room for myself, my own inner world. It's just depleted. That is a form of stress. This is all forms of stress or the brain will say it is not a safe time to be ovulating. Now, self-care, when we talk about, you know, how much time are you giving yourself and sort of feeding your own inner world, we think of, okay, essentially, how much self-care do you allow for yourself? And self-care is typically thought of as baths, facials, you know, going for a massage. But yes, those things are lovely. But the true meaning of self-care is living in alignment with your personality, with your wants, with your needs, with your purpose. What is it you are here for? What is it you want to be doing? And what lights you up? Living in alignment with all of those things. That's self-care. That is you, you know, essentially allowing you to be who you want to be, which is a huge, huge act of self-care. You would want that for the people you love. We need to want that for ourselves as well. Allowing for time spent doing things that make us feel lit up by it, you know, excited, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be excitement. It doesn't have to be this like, oh, I'm so happy all the time, but just feeling content, doing things that light us up. So we walk away from doing a certain task, whether it's work related, you know, whatever it might be, walking away from it, feeling like, yeah, I feel good about that. I enjoyed that. Being around people and places that light you up, including inside your home. What is your home like? Is it how you want it to be? Are you where you want to be? Are you living where you'd like to live? Starting and ending each day in a few minutes of calm, like journaling for 3 or 4 minutes every morning and at the end of your day before bed, or simply doing some 3 to 5 minutes of deep breathing, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. Getting more morning daylight exposure. So shortly after waking, getting out into natural daylight, being in darkness in the lead up to bedtime without being on your phone. All of these things are the real meaning of self-care that send a signal to your brain that all is well. Yes, the massage, the facial, the baths, these are lovely things to do, and they will, to an extent, tell your brain you're safe. But essentially, if you're not doing all of these other little things that are so much more important, that seem small, but they're actually huge, these are the things that are telling your brain all is well. We can ovulate. So I like to ask my clients, I put this in the forms, in the intake form, do you experience joy in your day? How much of your day do you feel content and happy? Now, our days are going to ebb and flow. Of course they are, in terms of our mood, something that we're doing that we might not want to do. But we do need a balance that's in favor, you know, of each day, each week, that's in favor of contentment versus having no joy, no contentment, no happiness. We do need to find that balance where throughout the day, you know, yeah, you know, things ebb and flow. But for the most part, in my days, I feel content. I feel pretty happy. I ask them, have they got long, never-ending to-do lists? And how do they feel about these lists? Most of us do have long, never-ending to-do lists. But how do we view them? So, for example, one person might say, yes, I have a long, never-ending to-do list, but I'm good. I don't feel stressed by it. I know I'll get there. I work through it. And somebody else might say, yep, and I feel drowned and overwhelmed by it. I'm pulling my hair out. I experience no joy in my day, no sense of contentment. And so that's the person who, although they have the same never-ending to-do list as the person before, who said she doesn't feel stressed by it, she knows she'll get there. The other person who does feel drowned and overwhelmed by the same to-do list is going to have that signal to the brain that think nothing is good, everything is bad, we must not ovulate, it's not a safe time to ovulate. So these are all big, big stressors. Now, for me personally, there's things I obviously, as everyone, there is, you know, things I have to do in my life that I don't really want to do. And that's obviously necessary. And that's okay to an extent. We need balance. But I have worked really hard over the years, particularly the last 5 years since turning 40, to create a life and a schedule that works for me, that's in alignment with what I want, how I want my days to look, how I essentially want my dream life to look. I've chipped away day after day for the last 5 or so years to design that life as much as I possibly can, one that allows me to be happy and content more often than I'm not. And if I'm not all the time, you know, if it's just here and there, fine. But if it's all the time, I step back and say, well, why am I feeling like this all the time? What needs to change? I have a career that I love, and I have specifically chosen that career because it's a passion. So that helps. But even if I didn't have this particular career that I'm lucky enough to feel so passionate about, and I was working a job that, you know, isn't necessarily my dream career, but there are still things I could do within that life to make it more towards the alignment, you know, even if that was things I had to do sort of outside of work or things within work that, you know, may just help to bring me more into alignment with what it is I actually want and who I want to be. Also, how I spend my week and my month. There'll always be things I have to say yes to just out of obligation that I don't really, you know, I'm not super overjoyed about, but the balance is definitely more in my favor. So, you know, it's not saying we have to just walk through life being completely selfish and oblivious to what anyone else might need. Of course, there's times we have to say yes, but for the most part, a lot of women are just saying yes all the time because they just don't even consider the fact that they can say no if they want to. You know, some weeks or months for me, there might be more events, more jobs, more kind of work stuff that I might have to do that I don't particularly want to do, or more obligations I don't really like. And what I notice in those weeks, if they are busier, so if I have busier weeks, more sociable, like as much as it might be things I like to do, if I'm busier socially or busier work-wise, I notice in those particular weeks I feel more stressed, more anxious, my sleep is off. I've got less energy, less kind of zest for life compared to a week or month where I spend more time doing the things I want to do, less unwanted obligations. In those times, I have more energy, less anxiety, I feel less stressed, I have much better sleep. So that tells me a lot. And I will go with that all the time, like trying to sort of always check in with myself. Is this just temporary that this particular week is extra busy, but after that I can, you know, make sure that these things don't occur again, then that's fine. But if it's going to be, if it is something that's ongoing, then, you know, it's starting to affect my sleep, my anxiety, my mood, and then my ability to ovulate, then I have to do something. Now, I'm not saying if you've got a life full of responsibilities and commitments that you don't want and you can't change that right now, that you're doomed. I'm not saying that at all, or that you should straight away change your life completely or you won't make any progesterone. That's not what I'm saying. I'm simply saying that you could start to make a list, for example, of the things that you love that you don't do, you don't have any time to do, you don't make any time to do, and then just subtly, slowly start to weave these into your life, into your days, into your weeks a little bit more than they are now or at all, and try to make more space than you currently have in any way that you can. Space for nothing, space to just be, and that over time will have a really great compounding effect on your the message that your brain is getting about who you are and what your life is like and whether it's a safe time to ovulate. Now, when I talk about, when people say about do things you love, you know, making sure you're doing something you love, yes, it might well be something as fancy as abseiling from a tall building or deep sea diving. You know, I really love deep sea diving, but I never get to do it. I'm not talking about those things. Those things, great. If you can get them in once a year, do them. But I'm also talking about really simple everyday things like, do you enjoy having a cup of your favorite hot drink, standing in the garden for 5 minutes every day and just listening to the birds, but you never do that? Do you enjoy a 10-minute walk through a local park in nature, just being, disconnecting from your phone, but you never do that? Do you enjoy 5 minutes reading a fiction book once a day in your break, meeting a friend for coffee, taking yourself to the cinema on your own? What are the things that you would love, you do really enjoy, the tiniest free things, but you just never ever do them? Whatever your things are, make a list of them and start to weave them in here and there. And if something comes up that you feel obliged to say yes to, but it isn't something you love, try to practice saying no. You know, you're likely not hurting anyone by saying no thanks. And instead, be committed to honoring and making space for the things that you do love and that you do really want to make time for. So this episode is really just to kind of encourage you to ask you how you can start to do things a bit differently in 2025 if need be. How can you create more space to be yourself, to live more on your terms, to actually do more of what you actually love, what you actually like? It might be a lot of areas of your life, or it might only be in one area of your life. Just a nice thing to reflect on over the next while, you know, as we're coming to the end of January now, just something to reflect on as we move through the year, basically. And hopefully you can end 2025 in a different spot where you're actually able to listen to something like this and say, yeah, I do honor myself and my needs and my wants. And for that, your ovulatory process is thanking you for it. So that's all I wanted to cover in this week's episode. And I hope it's been helpful in some way insightful. As always, let me know. My email and Instagram details are in the show notes. So drop me an email or you can send me a private message on Instagram, whatever works for you. And I'd love to hear anything that, you know, questions you've got about this episode or previous episodes, any suggestions that you've got for future episodes, any particular burning questions or topics that you might want me to cover. I'd love to hear from you. So do get in touch. And of course, for 2025, if you want to jump into the Empowered Perimenopause course subscription program, I'd love to have you in there. It's a real great space where we, it's such a great community of like-minded women and me, and it's a space for us to connect every month on a live coaching call, and every day inside the online community while you work your way through the Empowered Perimenopause course content. So you can check out all the details over on my website, francescaliparotti.com, and the details for that will also be in the show notes. So thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.